besieged Constantinople were detained in a crusade against the domestic enemy of Rome. The price of her avenger, the crown of the two Sicilies, was won and worn by the brother of St. Louis, by Charles, Count of Anjou and Provence, who led the chivalry of France on this holy expedition. The disaffection of his Christian subjects compelled Mainfroy to enlist a colony of Saracens whom his father had planted in Apulia, and this odious succor will explain the defiance of the Catholic hero who rejected all terms of accommodation. "Bear this message," said Charles, "to the Sultan of Nusira, that God and the sword are umpire between us, and that he shall either send me to paradise, or I will send him to the pit of hell." The armies met, and though I am ignorant of Mainfroy's doom in the other world, in this he lost his friends, his kingdom, and his life in the bloody battle of Benevento. Naples and Sicily were immediately peopled with a warlike race of French nobles, and their aspiring leader embraced the future conquest of Africa, Greece, and Palestine. The most specious reasons might point his first arms against the Byzantine Empire, and Palaeologus, diffident of his own strength, repeatedly appealed from the ambition of Charles to the humanity of St. Louis, who still preserved a just ascendant over the mind of his ferocious brother. For a while, the attention of that brother was confined at home by the invasion of Conradin, the last heir to the imperial house of Swabia. But the hapless boy sunk in the unequal conflict, and his execution on a public scaffold taught the rivals of Charles to tremble for their heads as well as their dominions. A second respite was obtained by the last crusade of St. Louis to the African coast, and the double motive of interest and duty urged the King of Naples to assist, with his powers and his presence, the holy enterprise. The death of St. Louis released him from the importunity of a virtuous censor. The King of Tunis confessed himself the tributary and vassal of the crown of Sicily, and the boldest of the French knights were free to enlist under his banner against the Greek Empire. A treaty and a marriage united his interest with the house of Courtenay. His daughter Beatrice was promised to Philip, son and heir of the Emperor Baldwin. A pension of 600 ounces of gold was allowed for his maintenance, and his generous father distributed among his aliens the kingdoms and provinces of the East, reserving only Constantinople and one day's journey round the city for the imperial domain. In this perilous moment, Palaeologus was the most eager to subscribe the creed and implore the protection of the Roman pontiff, who assumed, with propriety and weight, the character of an angel of peace, the common father of the Christians. By his voice, the sword of Charles was chained in the scabbard, and the Greek ambassadors beheld him in the Pope's antechamber, biting his ivory scepter in a transport of fury, and deeply resenting the refusal to enfranchise and consecrate his arms. He appears to have respected the disinterested mediation of Gregory X, but Charles was insensibly disgusted by the pride and partiality of Nicholas III, and his attachment to his kindred, the Orsini family, alienated the most strenuous champion from the service of the Church. The hostile league against the Greeks of Philip, the Latin Emperor, the King of the Two Sicilies, and the Republic of Venice was ripened into execution, and the election of Martin IV, a French pope, gave a sanction to the cause. Of the allies, Philip supplied his name, Martin, a bull of excommunication, the Venetians, a squadron of 40 galleys, and the formidable powers of Charles consisted of 40 counts, 10,000 men-at-arms, a numerous body of infantry, and a fleet of more than 300 ships and transports. A distant day was appointed for assembling this mighty force in the harbour of Brindisi, and a previous attempt was risked with a detachment of 300 knights who invaded Albania and besieged the fortress of Belgrade. Their defeat might amuse with a triumph of the vanity of Constantinople, But the more sagacious Michael, despairing of his arms, depended on the effects of a conspiracy, on the secret workings of a rat who gnawed the bowstring of the Sicilian tyrant. Among the proscribed adherents of the House of Swabia, John of Procida forfeited a small island of that name in the Bay of Naples. His birth was noble, but his education was learned, and in the poverty of exile he was relieved by the practice of physic, which he had studied in the school of Salerno. Fortune had left him nothing to lose except life, and to despise life is the first qualification of a rebel. Procida was endowed with the art of negotiation, to enforce his reasons and disguise his motives, and in his various transactions with nations and men, he could persuade each party that he labored solely for their interest. The new kingdoms of Charles were afflicted by every species of fiscal and military oppression, and the lives and fortunes of his Italian subjects were sacrificed to the greatness of their master and the licentiousness of his followers. The hatred of Naples was repressed by his presence, but the looser government of his vice-regents excited the contempt as well as the aversion of the Sicilians. The island was roused to a sense of freedom by the eloquence of Procida, and he displayed to every baron his private interest in the common cause. In the Conference of Foreign Aid, he successively visited the courts of the Greek emperor and of Peter, king of Aragon, who possessed the maritime countries of Valencia and Catalonia. To the ambitious Peter, a crown was presented which he might justly claim by his marriage with the sister of Mainfroi, and by the dying voice of Conradin, who from the scaffold had cast a ring to his heir and avenger. Palaeologus was easily persuaded to divert his enemy from a foreign war by rebellion at home, and a Greek subsidy of 25,000 ounces of gold was most profitably applied to arm a Catalan fleet, which sailed under a holy banner to the specious attack of the Saracens of Africa. In the disguise of a monk or beggar, the indefatigable missionary of revolt flew from Constantinople to Rome, and from Sicily to Saragossa. The treaty was sealed with the signet of Pope Nicholas himself, the enemy of Charles, and his deed of gift transferred the fiefs of St. Peter from the house of Anjou to that of Aragon. So widely diffused and so freely circulated, the secret was preserved above 2 years with impenetrable discretion, and each of the conspirators imbibed the maxim of Peter, who declared that he would cut off his left hand if it were conscious of the intentions of his right. The mine was prepared with deep and dangerous artifice, but it may be questioned whether the instant explosion of Palermo were the effect of accident or design. On the vigil of Easter, a procession of the disarmed citizens visited a church without the walls, and a noble damsel was rudely insulted by a French soldier. The ravisher was instantly punished with death, and if the people was at first scattered by military force, their numbers and fury prevailed. The conspirators seized the opportunity. The flame spread over the island, and 8,000 French were exterminated in a promiscuous massacre, which has obtained the name of the Sicilian Vespers. From every city the banners of freedom and the church were displayed. The revolt was inspired by the presence, or the soul, of Procida and Peter of Aragon, who sailed from the African coast to Palermo, was saluted as the king and savior of the isle. By the rebellion of a people on whom he had so long trampled with impunity, Charles was astonished and confounded, and in the first agony of grief and devotion he was heard to exclaim, "O God! If thou hast decreed to humble me, grant me at least a gentle and gradual descent from the pinnacle of greatness." His fleet and army, which already filled the seaports of Italy, were hastily recalled from the service of the Grecian War, and the situation of Messina exposed that town to the first storm of his revenge. Feeble in themselves and yet hopeless of foreign succour, the citizens would have repented and submitted on the assurance of full pardon and their ancient privileges. But the pride of the monarch was already rekindled, and the most fervent entreaties of the legate could extort no more than a promise that he would forgive the remainder after a chosen list of 800 rebels had been yielded to his discretion. The despair of the Messinese renewed their courage. Peter of Aragon approached to their chief, and his rival was driven back by the failure of provision and the terrors of the equinox to the Calabrian shore. At the same moment, the Catalan admiral, the famous Roger de Loria, swept the channel with an invincible squadron. The French fleet, more numerous in transports than in galleys, was either burnt or destroyed, and the same blow assured the independence of Sicily and the safety of the Greek Empire. A few days before his death, the Emperor Michael rejoiced in the fall of an enemy whom he hated and esteemed, and perhaps he might be content with the popular judgment that had they not been matched with each other, Constantinople and Italy must speedily have obeyed the same master. From this disastrous moment, the life of Charles was a series of misfortunes. His capital was insulted, his son was made prisoner, and he sunk into the grave without recovering the Isle of Sicily, which, after a war of 20 years, was finally severed from the throne of Naples and transferred as an independent kingdom to a younger branch of the House of Aragon. I shall not, I trust, be accused of superstition, but I must remark that even in this world the natural order of events will sometimes afford the strong appearances of moral retribution. The first Palaeologus had saved his empire by involving the kingdoms of the West in rebellion and blood, and from these scenes of discord uprose a generation of iron men who assaulted and endangered the empire of his son. In modern times, our debts and taxes are the secret poison which still corrodes the bosom of peace. But in the weak and disorderly government of the Middle Ages, it was agitated by the present evil of the disbanded armies. Too idle to work, too proud to beg, the mercenaries were accustomed to a life of rapine. They could rob with more dignity and effect under a banner and a chief, and the sovereign, to whom their service was useless and their presence importunate, endeavoured to discharge the torrent on some neighbouring countries. After the Peace of Sicily, many thousands of Genoese, Catalans, etc., who had fought by sea and land under the standard of Anjou or Aragon, were blended into one nation by the resemblance of their manners and interest. They heard that the Greek provinces of Asia were invaded by the Turks. They resolved to share the harvest of pay and plunder, and Frederick, King of Sicily, most liberally contributed the means of their departure. In a warfare of 20 years, a ship or a camp was become their country. Arms were their sole profession and property. Valor was the only virtue which they knew. Their women had imbibed the fearless temper of their lovers and husbands. It was reported that with a stroke of their broadsword, the Catalans could cleave a horseman and a horse, and the report itself was a powerful weapon. Roger de Flor was the most popular of their chiefs, and his personal merit overshadowed the dignity of his prouder rivals of Aragon. The offspring of a marriage between a German gentleman of the court of Frederick II and a damsel of Brindisi, Roger was successively a Templar, an apostate, a pirate, and at length the richest and most powerful admiral of the Mediterranean. He sailed from Messina to Constantinople with 18 galleys, 4 great ships, and 8,000 adventurers. And his previous treaty was faithfully accomplished by Andronicus the Elder, who accepted with joy and terror this formidable succor. A palace was allotted for his reception, and a niece of the emperor was given in marriage to the valiant stranger, who was immediately created Great Duke or Admiral of Romania. After a decent repose, he transported his troops over the Propontis and boldly led them against the Turks. In two bloody battles, 30,000 of the Muslims were slain. He raised the siege of Philadelphia and deserved the name of the Deliverer of Asia. But after a short season of prosperity, the cloud of slavery and ruin again burst on that unhappy province. The inhabitants escaped, says a Greek historian, from the smoke into the flames, and the hostility of the Turks was less pernicious than the friendship of the Catalans. The lives and fortunes which they had rescued, they considered as their own. The willing or reluctant maid was saved from the race of circumcision for the embraces of a Christian soldier. The exaction of fines and supplies was enforced by licentious rapine and arbitrary executions. And, on the resistance of Magnesia, the great duke besieged a city of the Roman Empire. These disorders he excused by the wrongs and passions of a victorious army. Nor would his own authority or person have been safe had he dared to punish his faithful followers, who were defrauded of the just and covenanted price of their services. The threats and complaints of Andronicus disclosed the nakedness of the empire. His golden bull had invited no more than 500 horse and 1,000 foot soldiers, yet the crowds of volunteers who migrated to the east had been enlisted and fed by his spontaneous bounty. While his bravest allies were content with 3 byzants, or pieces of gold, for their monthly pay, an ounce or even 2 ounces of gold were assigned to the Catalans, whose annual pension would thus amount to near £100 sterling. One of their chiefs had modestly rated at 300,000 crowns the value of his future merits, and above 1,000,000 had been issued from the treasury for the maintenance of these costly mercenaries. A cruel tax had been imposed on the corn of the husbandman. 1/3 was retrenched from the salaries of the public officers, and the standard of the coin was so shamefully debased that of the 24 parts, only 5 were of pure gold. At the summons of the emperor, Roger evacuated a province which no longer supplied the materials of rapine. But he refused to disperse his troops. And while his style was respectful, his conduct was independent and hostile. He protested that if the emperor should march against him, he would advance 40 paces to kiss the ground before him. But in rising from this prostrate attitude, Roger had a life and sword at the service of his friends. The great Duke of Romania condescended to accept the title and ornaments of Caesar, but he rejected the new proposal of the government of Asia with a subsidy of corn and money. On condition that he should reduce his troops to the harmless number of 3,000 men. Assassination is the last resource of cowards. The Caesar was tempted to visit the royal residence of Adrianople. Then the apartment, and before the eyes of the Empress, he was stabbed by the Alani guards. And though the deed was imputed to their private revenge, his countrymen, who dwelt at Constantinople in the security of peace, were involved in the same proscription by the prince or people. The loss of their leader intimidated the crowd of adventurers, who hoisted the sails of flight and were soon scattered around the coasts of the Mediterranean. But a veteran band of 1,500 Catalans, or French, stood firm in the strong fortress of Gallipoli on the Hellespont, displayed the banners of Aragon, and offered to revenge and justify their chief by an equal combat of 10 or 100 warriors. Instead of accepting this bold defiance, the Emperor Michael, the son and colleague of Andronicus, resolved to oppress them with the weight of multitudes. Every nerve was strained to form an army of 13,000 horse and 30,000 foot, and the Propontis was covered with the ships of the Greeks and Genoese. In 2 battles by sea and land, these mighty forces were encountered and overthrown by the despair and discipline of the Catalans. The young emperor fled to the palace, and an insufficient guard of light horse was left for the protection of the open country. Victory renewed the hopes and numbers of the adventurers. Every nation was blended under the name and standard of the great company, and 3,000 Turkish proselytes deserted from the imperial service to join this military association. In the possession of Gallipoli, the Catalans intercepted the trade of Constantinople and the Black Sea, while they spread their devastation on either side of the Hellespont over the confines of Europe and Asia. To prevent their approach, the greatest part of the Byzantine territory was laid waste by the Greeks themselves. The peasants and their cattle retired into the city, and myriads of sheep and oxen, for which neither place nor food could be procured, were unprofitably slaughtered on the same day. Four times the Emperor Andronicus sued for peace, and four times he was inflexibly repulsed, till the want of provisions and the discord of the chiefs compelled the Catalans to evacuate the banks of the Hellespont and the neighborhood of the capital. After their separation from the Turks, the remains of the great company pursued their march through Macedonia and Thessaly to seek a new establishment in the heart of Greece. After some ages of oblivion, Greece was awakened to new misfortunes by the arms of the Latins. In the 250 years between the first and the last conquest of Constantinople, that venerable land was disputed by a multitude of petty tyrants. Without the comforts of freedom and genius, her ancient cities were again plunged in foreign and intestine war. And if servitude be preferable to anarchy, they might repose with joy under the Turkish yoke. I shall not pursue the obscure and various dynasties that rose and fell on the continent or in the isles, but our silence on the fate of Athens would argue a strange ingratitude to the first and purest school of liberal science and amusement. In the partition of the empire, the principality of Athens and Thebes was assigned to Otho de la Roche, a noble warrior of Burgundy, with the title of Great Duke, which the Latins understood in their own sense, and the Greeks more foolishly derived from the age of Constantine. Otho followed the standard of the Marquis of Montferrat, the ample state which he acquired by a miracle of conduct or fortune, was peaceably inherited by his son and two grandsons, till the family, though not the nation, was changed by the marriage of an heiress into the elder branch of the House of Brienne. The son of that marriage, Walter de Brienne, succeeded to the Duchy of Athens, and with the aid of some Catalan mercenaries whom he invested with fiefs, reduced above 30 castles of the vassal or neighboring lords. But when he was informed of the approach and ambition of the great company, he collected a force of 700 knights, 6,400 horse, and 8,000 foot, and boldly met them on the banks of the river Cephisus in Boeotia. The Catalans amounted to no more than 3,500 horse and 4,000 foot, but the deficiency of numbers was compensated by stratagem and order. They formed round their camp an artificial inundation. The Duke and his knights advanced without fear or precaution on the verdant meadow. Their horses plunged into the bog, and he was cut in pieces with the greatest part of the French cavalry. His family and nation were expelled, and his son, Walter de Brienne, the titular Duke of Athens, the tyrant of Florence, and the constable of France, lost his life in the field of Poitiers. Attica and Boeotia were the rewards of the victorious Catalans. They married the widows and daughters of the slain, and during 14 years the great company was the terror of the Grecian states. Their factions drove them to acknowledge the sovereignty of the House of Aragon, and during the remainder of the 14th century, Athens, as a government or an appanage, was successively bestowed by the kings of Sicily. After the French and Catalans, the third dynasty was that of the Acaioli, a family, plebeian at Florence, potent at Naples, and sovereign in Greece. Athens, which they embellished with new buildings, became the capital of a state that extended over Thebes, Argos, Corinth, Delphi, and a part of Thessaly. and their reign was finally determined by Mohammed II, who strangled the last duke and educated his sons in the discipline and religion of the Seraglio. Athens, though no more than the shadow of her former self, still contains about 8,000 or 10,000 inhabitants. Of these, 3/4 are Greeks in religion and language, and the Turks, who compose the remainder, have relaxed in their intercourse with the citizens somewhat of the pride and gravity of their national character. The olive tree, the gift of Minerva, flourishes in Attica, nor has the honey of Mount Hymettus lost any part of its exquisite flavor. But the languid trade is monopolized by strangers, and the agriculture of a barren land is abandoned to the vagrant Wallachians. The Athenians are still distinguished by the subtlety and acuteness of their understandings, but these qualities, unless ennobled by freedom and enlightened by study, will degenerate into a low and selfish cunning. And it is a proverbial saying of the country, "From the Jews of Thessalonica, the Turks of Negropont, and the Greeks of Athens, good Lord deliver us." This artful people has eluded the tyranny of the Turkish bashaws by an expedient which alleviates their servitude and aggravates their shame. About the middle of the last century, the Athenians chose for their protector the Kisla Aga, or chief black eunuch of the Seraglio. This Ethiopian slave, who possesses the sultan's ear, condescends to accept the tribute of 30,000 crowns. His lieutenant, the Waywood, whom he annually confirms, may reserve for his own about 5,000 or 6,000 more. And such is the policy of the citizens that they seldom fail to remove and punish an oppressive governor. Their private differences are decided by the archbishop, one of the richest prelates of the Greek church, since he possesses a revenue of 1,000 pounds sterling, and by a tribunal of the 8 Geronti, or elders, chosen in the 8 quarters of the city. The noble families cannot trace their pedigree above 300 years. But their principal members are distinguished by a grave demeanor, a fur cap, and the lofty appellation of Archon. By some, who delight in the contrast, the modern language of Athens is represented as the most corrupt and barbarous of the 70 dialects of the vulgar Greek. This picture is too darkly colored, but it would not be easy in the country of Plato and Demosthenes to find a reader or a copy of their works. The Athenians walk with supine indifference among the glorious ruins of antiquity, and such is the debasement of their character that they are incapable of admiring the genius of their predecessors. Chapter 63. Civil Wars and Ruin of the Greek Empire. Reigns of Andronicus, the Elder and Younger, and John Palaeologus. Regency, Revolt, Reign, and Abdication of John Cantacuzini. Establishment of a Genoese colony at Pera, or Galata. Their wars with the Empire and City of Constantinople. The long reign of Andronicus the Elder is chiefly memorable by the disputes of the Greek church, the invasion of the Catalans, and the rise of the Ottoman power. He is celebrated as the most learned and virtuous prince of the age, but such virtue and such learning contributed neither to the perfection of the individual nor to the happiness of society. A slave of the most abject superstition, he was surrounded on all sides by visible and invisible enemies. Nor were the flames of hell less dreadful to his fancy than those of a Catalan or Turkish war. Under the reign of the Palaeologi, the choice of the patriarch was the most important business of the state. The heads of the Greek church were ambitious and fanatic monks, and their vices or virtues, their learning or ignorance, were equally mischievous or contemptible. By his intemperate discipline, the patriarch, Athanasius, excited the hatred of the clergy and people. He was said to declare that the sinner should swallow the last dregs of the cup of penance, and the foolish tale was propagated of his punishing a sacrilegious ass that had tasted the lettuce of a convent garden. Driven from the throne by the universal clamour, Athanasius composed before his retreat two papers of a very opposite cast. His public testament was in the tone of charity and resignation. The private codicil breathed the direst anathemas against the authors of his disgrace, whom he excluded forever from the communion of the Holy Trinity, the angels, and the saints. This last paper he enclosed in an earthen pot, which was placed by his order on the top of one of the pillars in the dome of Santa Sophia, in the distant hope of discovery and revenge. At the end of 4 years, some youths, climbing by a ladder in search of pigeons' nests, detected the fatal secret, and as Andronicus felt himself touched and bound by the excommunication, he trembled on the brink of the abyss which had been so treacherously dug under his feet. A synod of bishops was instantly convened to debate this important question. The rashness of these clandestine anathemas was generally condemned, but as the knot could be untied only by the same hand, as that hand was now deprived of the crosier, it appeared that this posthumous decree was irrevocable by any earthly power. Some faint testimonies of repentance and pardon were extorted from the author of the mischief, but the conscience of the emperor was still wounded, and he desired, with no less ardor than Athanasius himself, the restoration of a patriarch, by whom alone he could be healed. At the dead of night, a monk rudely knocked at the door of the royal bedchamber, announcing a revelation of plague and famine, of inundations and earthquakes. Andronicus started from his bed and spent the night in prayer till he felt, or thought that he felt, a slight motion of the earth. The emperor, on foot, led the bishops and monks to the cell of Athanasius, and after a proper resistance, the saint, from whom this message had been sent, consented to absolve the prince and govern the Church of Constantinople. Untamed by disgrace and hardened by solitude, the shepherd was again odious to the flock, and his enemies contrived a singular, and as it proved, a successful mode of revenge. In the night they stole away the footstool, or foot-cloth, of his throne, which they secretly replaced with the decoration of a satirical picture. The emperor was painted with a bridle in his mouth, and Athanasius leading the tractable beast to the feet of Christ. The authors of the libel were detected and punished, but as their lives had been spared, the Christian priest in sullen indignation retired to his cell, and the eyes of Andronicus, which had been opened for a moment, were again closed by his successor. If this transaction be one of the most curious and important of a reign of 50 years, I cannot at least accuse the brevity of my materials, since I reduce into some few pages the enormous folios of Pachymer, Cantacuzini, and Nicephorus Gregoros, who have composed the prolix and languid story of the times. The name and situation of the emperor, John Cantacuzini, might inspire the most lively curiosity. His memorials of 40 years extend from the revolt of the younger Andronicus to his own abdication of the empire, and it is observed that, like Moses and Caesar, he was the principal actor in the scenes which he describes. But in this eloquent work we should vainly seek the sincerity of a hero or a penitent. Retired in a cloister from the vices and passions of the world, he presents not a confession, but an apology of the life of an ambitious statesman. instead of unfolding the true counsels and characters of men, he displays the smooth and specious surface of events, highly varnished with his own praises and those of his friends. Their motives are always pure, their ends always legitimate. They conspire and rebel without any views of interest, and the violence which they inflict or suffer is celebrated as the spontaneous effect of reason and virtue. After the example of the first of the Palaeologi, the elder Andronicus associated his son Michael to the honors of the purple, and from the age of 18 to his premature death, that prince was acknowledged above 25 years as the second emperor of the Greeks. At the head of an army, he excited neither the fears of the enemy nor the jealousy of the court. His modesty and patience were never tempted to compute the years of his father, nor was that father compelled to repent of his liberality either by the virtues or vices of his son. The son of Michael was named Andronicus from his grandfather, to whose early favor he was introduced by that nominal resemblance. The blossoms of wit and beauty increased the fondness of the elder Andronicus, and with the common vanity of age, he expected to realize in the second the hope which had been disappointed in the first generation. The boy was educated in the palace as an heir and a favorite, and in the oaths and acclamations of the people, the august triad was formed by the names of the father, the son, and the grandson. But the younger Andronicus was speedily corrupted by his infant greatness, while he beheld with puerile impatience the double obstacle that hung and might long hang over his rising ambition. It was not to acquire fame or to diffuse happiness that he so eagerly aspired. Wealth and impunity were in his eyes the most precious attributes of a monarch, and his first indiscreet demand was the sovereignty of some rich and fertile island, where he might lead a life of independence and pleasure. The emperor was offended by the loud and frequent intemperance which disturbed his capital. The sums which his parsimony denied were supplied by the Genoese usurers of Pera, and the oppressive debt, which consolidated the interest of a faction, could be discharged only by revolution. A beautiful female, a matron in rank, a prostitute in manners, had instructed the young Andronicus in the rudiments of love. But he had reason to suspect the nocturnal visits of a rival, and a stranger passing through the street was pierced by the arrows of his guards, who were placed in ambush at her door. That stranger was his brother, Prince Manuel, who languished and died of his wound, and the Emperor Michael, their common father, whose health was in a declining state, expired on the 8th day, lamenting the loss of both his children. However guiltless in his intention, the younger Andronicus might impute a brother's and a father's death to the consequence of his own vices. And deep was the sigh of thinking and feeling men when they perceived, instead of sorrow and repentance, his ill-dissembled joy on the removal of 2 odious competitors. By these melancholy events and the increase of his disorders, the mind of the elder emperor was gradually alienated, and after many fruitless reproofs, he transferred on another grandson his hopes and affection. The change was announced by the new oath of allegiance to the reigning sovereign, and the person whom he should appoint for his successor. And the acknowledged heir, after a repetition of insults and complaints, was exposed to the indignity of a public trial. Before the sentence, which would probably have condemned him to a dungeon or a cell, the emperor was informed that the palace courts were filled with the armed followers of his grandson. The judgment was softened to a treaty of reconciliation, and the triumphant escape of the prince encouraged the ardor of the younger faction. Yet the capital, the clergy, and the senate adhered to the person, or at least to the government of the old emperor, and it was only in the provinces, by flight and revolt and foreign succor, that the malcontents could hope to vindicate their cause and subvert his throne. The soul of the enterprise was the great domestic John Cantacuzini, The sally from Constantinople is the first date of his actions and memorials, and if his own pen be most descriptive of his patriotism, an unfriendly historian has not refused to celebrate the zeal and ability which he displayed in the service of the young emperor. That prince escaped from the capital under the pretense of hunting, erected his standard at Adrianople, and in a few days assembled 50,000 horse and foot, whom neither honour nor duty could have armed against the barbarians. Such a force might have saved or commanded the empire, but their counsels were discordant, their motions were slow and doubtful, and their progress was checked by intrigue and negotiation. The quarrel of the two Andronici was protracted and suspended, and renewed during a ruinous period of 7 years. In the first treaty, the relics of the Greek Empire were divided. Constantinople, Thessalonica, and the islands were left to the elder, while the younger acquired the sovereignty of the greatest part of Thrace, from Philippi to the Byzantine limit. By the second treaty, he stipulated the payment of his troops, his immediate coronation, and an adequate share of the power and revenue of the state. The Third Civil War was terminated by the surprise of Constantinople, the final retreat of the old emperor, and the sole reign of his victorious grandson. The reasons of this delay may be found in the characters of the men and of the times. When the heir of the monarchy first pleaded his wrongs and his apprehensions, he was heard with pity and applause, and his adherents repeated on all sides the inconsistent promise that he would increase the pay of the soldiers and alleviate the burdens of the people. The grievances of 40 years were mingled in his revolt, and the rising generation was fatigued by the endless prospect of a reign whose favorites and maxims were of other times. The youth of Andronicus had been without spirit. His age was without reverence. His taxes produced an unusual revenue of 500,000 pounds. Yet the riches of the sovereigns of Christendom was incapable of maintaining 3,000 horse and 20 galleys to resist the destructive progress of the Turks. "How different," said the younger Andronicus, "is my situation from that of the son of Philip. Alexander might complain that his father would leave him nothing to conquer. Alas, my grandsire will leave me nothing to lose." But the Greeks were soon admonished that the public disorders could not be healed by civil war, and that their young favorite was not destined to be the savior of a falling empire. On the first repulse, his party was broken by his own levity, their intestine discord, and the intrigues of the ancient court, which tempted each malcontent to desert or betray the cause of the rebellion. Andronicus the younger was touched with remorse, or fatigued with business, or deceived by negotiation. Pleasure rather than power was his aim, and the license of maintaining 1,000 hounds, 1,000 hawks, and 1,000 huntsmen was sufficient to sully his fame and disarm his ambition. Let us now survey the catastrophe of this busy plot, and the final situation of the principal actors. The age of Andronicus was consumed in civil discord, and amidst the events of war and treaty, his power and reputation continually decayed, till the fatal night in which the gates of the city and palace were opened without resistance to his grandson. His principal commander scorned the repeated warnings of danger, and retiring to rest in the vain security of ignorance, abandoned the feeble monarch, with some priests and pages, to the terrors of a sleepless night. These terrors were quickly realized by the hostile shouts which proclaimed the titles and victory of Andronicus the Younger, and the aged emperor, falling prostrate before an image of the Virgin, dispatched a suppliant message to resign the scepter and to obtain his life at the hands of the conqueror. The answer of his grandson was decent and pious. At the prayer of his friends, the younger Andronicus assumed the sole administration. But the elder still enjoyed the name and preeminence of the first emperor. the use of a great palace, and a pension of 24,000 pieces of gold, one half of which was assigned on the royal treasury, and the other on the fishery of Constantinople. But his impotence was soon exposed to contempt and oblivion. The vast silence of the palace was disturbed only by the cattle and poultry of the neighbourhood, which roved with impunity through the solitary courts, and a reduced allowance of 10,000 pieces of gold was all that he could ask, and more than he could hope. His calamities were embittered by the gradual extinction of sight. His confinement was rendered each day more rigorous, and, during the absence and sickness of his grandson, his inhuman keepers, by the threats of instant death, compelled him to exchange the purple for the monastic habit and profession. The monk Antony had renounced the pomp of the world, yet he had occasion for a coarse fur in the winter season, and as wine was forbidden by his confessor, and water by his physician, the sherbet of Egypt was his common drink. It was not without difficulty that the late emperor could procure 3 or 4 pieces to satisfy these simple wants, and if he bestowed the gold to relieve the more painful distress of a friend, the sacrifice is of some weight in the scale of humanity and religion. 4 years after his abdication, Andronicus, or Antony, expired in a cell in the 74th year of his age, and the last strain of adulation could only promise a more splendid crown of glory in heaven than he had enjoyed upon earth. Nor was the reign of the younger more glorious or fortunate than that of the elder Andronicus. He gathered the fruits of ambition, but the taste was transient and bitter. In the supreme station he lost the remains of his early popularity, and the defects of his character became still more conspicuous to the world. The public reproach urged him to march in person against the Turks, nor did his courage fail in the hour of trial, but a defeat and a wound were the only trophies of his expedition in Asia, which confirmed the establishment of the Ottoman monarchy. The abuses of the civil government attained their full maturity and perfection. His neglect of forms and the confusion of national dresses are deplored by the Greeks as the fatal symptoms of the decay of the empire. Andronicus was old before his time. The intemperance of youth had accelerated the infirmities of age, and after being rescued from a dangerous malady by nature, or physic, or the Virgin, he was snatched away before he had accomplished his 45th year. He was twice married, and as the progress of the Latins in arms and arts had softened the prejudices of the Byzantine court, his 2 wives were chosen in the princely houses of Germany and Italy. The first, Agnes, at home, Irene, in Greece, was the daughter of the Duke of Brunswick. Her father was a petty lord in the poor and savage regions of the north of Germany. Yet he derived some revenue from his silver mines, and his family is celebrated by the Greeks as the most ancient and noble of the Teutonic name. After the death of this childish princess, Andronicus sought in marriage Jane, the sister of the Count of Savoy, and his suit was preferred to that of the French king. The count respected in his sister the superior majesty of a Roman empress. Her retinue was composed of knights and ladies. She was regenerated and crowned in Santa Sophia under the more orthodox appellation of Anne. And at the nuptial feast, the Greeks and Italians vied with each other in the martial exercises of tilts and tournaments. The Empress Anne of Savoy survived her husband. Their son, John Palaeologus, was left an orphan and an emperor in the 9th year of his age, and his weakness was protected by the first and most deserving of the Greeks. The long and cordial friendship of his father for John Cantacuzini is alike honourable to the prince and the subject. It had been formed amidst the pleasures of their youth. Their families were almost equally noble, and the recent lustre of the purple was amply compensated by the energy of a private education. We have seen that the young emperor was saved by Cantacuzini from the power of his grandfather, and after 6 years of civil war, the same favourite brought him back in triumph to the palace of Constantinople. Under the reign of Andronicus the Younger, the great domestic ruled the emperor and the empire, and it was by his valour and conduct that the Isle of Lesbos and the Principality of Aetolia were restored to their ancient allegiance. His enemies confessed that, among the public robbers, Cantacuzini alone was moderate and abstemious, and the free and voluntary account which he produces of his own wealth may sustain the presumption that he was devolved by inheritance and not accumulated by rapine. He does not indeed specify the value of his money, plate, and jewels, yet after a voluntary gift of 200 vases of silver, after much had been secreted by his friends and plundered by his foes, his forfeit treasures were sufficient for the equipment of a fleet of 70 galleys. He does not measure the size and number of his estates, but his granaries were heaped with an incredible store of wheat and barley, and the labour of 1,000 yoke of oxen might cultivate, according to the practice of antiquity, about 62,500 acres of arable land. His pastures were stocked with 2,500 brood mares, 200 camels, 300 mules, 500 asses, 5,000 horned cattle, 50,000 hogs, and 70,000 sheep. A precious record of rural opulence in the last period of the empire, and in a land most probably in Thrace, so repeatedly wasted by foreign and domestic hostility. The favour of Cantacuzini was above his fortune. In the moments of familiarity, in the hour of sickness, the emperor was desirous to level the distance between them and pressed his friend to accept the diadem and purple. The virtue of the great domestic, which is attested by his own pen, resisted the dangerous proposal, but the last testament of Andronicus the Younger named him the guardian of his son and the regent of the empire. Had the regent found a suitable return of obedience and gratitude, perhaps he would have acted with pure and zealous fidelity in the service of his pupil. A guard of 500 soldiers watched over his person and the palace. The funeral of the late emperor was decently performed. The capital was silent and submissive, and 500 letters which Cantacuzini dispatched in the first month informed the provinces of their loss and their duty. The prospect of a tranquil minority was blasted by the great duke or admiral Apocaucus, and to exaggerate his perfidy, the imperial historian is pleased to magnify his own imprudence in raising him to that office against the advice of his more sagacious sovereign. Bold and subtle, rapacious and profuse, the avarice and ambition of Apocaucus were by turns subservient to each other, and his talents were applied to the ruin of his country. His arrogance was heightened by the command of a naval force and an impregnable castle, and under the mask of oaths and flattery he secretly conspired against his benefactor. The female court of the empress was bribed and directed. He encouraged Anne of Savoy to assert, by the law of nature, the tutelage of her son. The love of power was disguised by the anxiety of maternal tenderness, and the founder of the Palaeologi had instructed his posterity to dread the example of a perfidious guardian. The patriarch John of Apri was a proud and feeble old man, encompassed by numerous and hungry kindred. He produced an obsolete epistle of Andronicus, which bequeathed the prince and people to his pious care. The fate of his predecessor, Arsenius, prompted him to prevent, rather than punish, the crimes of a usurper, and Apocaucus smiled at the success of his end flattery when he beheld the Byzantine priest assuming the state and temporal claims of the Roman pontiff. Between three persons so different in their situation and character, a private league was concluded. A shadow of authority was restored to the Senate, and the people was tempted by the name of freedom. By this powerful confederacy, the great domestic was assaulted at first with clandestine, at length with open arms. His prerogatives were disputed, his opinions slighted, his friends persecuted, and his safety was threatened both in the camp and city. In his absence on the public service, he was accused of treason, proscribed as an enemy of the church and state, and delivered with all his adherents to the sword of justice, the vengeance of the people, and the power of the devil. His fortunes were confiscated. His aged mother was cast into prison. All his past services were buried in oblivion, and he was driven by injustice to perpetrate the crime of which he was accused. From the review of his preceding conduct, Cantacuzini appears to have been guiltless of any treasonable designs, and the only suspicion of his innocence must arise from the vehemence of his protestations and the sublime purity which he ascribes to his own virtue. While the Empress and the Patriarch still affected the appearances of harmony, he repeatedly solicited the permission of retiring to a private and even a monastic life. After he had been declared a public enemy, it was his fervent wish to throw himself at the feet of the young emperor and to receive, without a murmur, the stroke of the executioner. It was not without reluctance that he listened to the voice of reason, which inculcated the sacred duty of saving his family and friends, and proved that he could only save them by drawing the sword and assuming the imperial title. In the strong city of Demotica, his peculiar domain, the emperor John Cantacuzinus was invested with the purple buskins. His right leg was clothed by his noble kinsmen, the left by the Latin chiefs, on whom he conferred the order of knighthood. But even in this act of revolt he was still studious of loyalty, and the titles of John Palaeologus and Anne of Savoy were proclaimed before his own name and that of his wife Irene. Such vain ceremony is a thin disguise of rebellion, nor are there perhaps any personal wrongs that can authorize a subject to take arms against his sovereign. But the want of preparation and success may confirm the assurance of the usurper that this decisive step was the effect of necessity rather than of choice. Constantinople adhered to the young emperor. The king of Bulgaria was invited to the relief of Adrianople. The principal cities of Thrace and Macedonia, after some hesitation, renounced their obedience to the great domestic, and the leaders of the troops and provinces were induced by their private interest to prefer the loose dominion of a woman and a priest. The army of Cantacuzini, in 16 divisions, was stationed on the banks of the Milas to tempt or to intimidate the capital. It was dispersed by treachery or fear, and the officers, more especially the mercenary Latins, accepted the bribes and embraced the service of the Byzantine court. After this loss, the rebel emperor, he fluctuated between the two characters, took the road to Thessalonica with a chosen remnant. But he failed in his enterprise on that important place, and he was closely pursued by the great duke, his enemy, Upper Caucasus, at the head of a superior power by sea and land. Driven from the coast, in his march, or rather flight, into the mountains of Serbia, Cantacuzini assembled his troops to scrutinize those who were worthy and willing to accompany his broken fortunes. A base majority bowed and retired, and his trusty band was diminished to 2,000 and at last to 500 volunteers. The Kral, or despot of the Serbians, received him with general hospitality, but the ally was insensibly degraded to a suppliant, a hostage, a captive. And in this miserable dependence he waited at the door of the barbarian, who could dispose of the life and liberty of a Roman emperor. The most tempting offers could not persuade the Kral to violate his trust, but he soon inclined to the stronger side, and his friend was dismissed without injury to a new vicissitude of hopes and perils. Near 6 years the flame of discord burnt with various success and unabated rage. The cities were distracted by the faction of the nobles and the plebeians, the Cantacuzini and Palaeologi, and the Bulgarians, the Serbians, and the Turks were invoked on both sides as the instruments of private ambition and the common ruin. The regent deplored the calamities of which he was the author and victim, and his own experience might dictate a just and lively remark on the different nature of foreign and civil war. The former, said he, is the external warmth of summer, always tolerable and often beneficial. The latter is the deadly heat of a fever which consumes, without a remedy, the vitals of the Constitution. The introduction of barbarians and savages into the contests of civilized nations is a measure pregnant with shame and mischief, which the interest of the moment may compel, but which is reprobated by the best principles of humanity and reason. It is the practice of both sides to accuse their enemies of the guilt of the first alliances, and those who fail in their negotiations are loudest in their censure of the example which they envy and would gladly imitate. The Turks of Asia were less barbarous, perhaps, than the shepherds of Bulgaria and Serbia, but their religion rendered them implacable foes of Rome and Christianity. To acquire the friendship of their emirs, the two factions vied with each other in baseness and profusion. The dexterity of Cantacuzini obtained the preference, but the succor and victory were dearly purchased by the marriage of his daughter with an infidel, the captivity of many thousand Christians, and the passage of the Ottomans into Europe, the last and fatal stroke in the fall of the Roman Empire. The inclining scale was decided in his favor by the death of Apocalcus, the just, though singular, retribution of his crimes. A crowd of nobles or plebeians whom he feared or hated had been seized by his orders in the capital and the provinces, and the old palace of Constantine was assigned as the place of their confinement. Some alterations in raising the walls and narrowing the cells had been ingeniously contrived to prevent their escape and aggravate their misery, and the work was incessantly pressed by the daily visits of the tyrant. His guardians watched at the gate, and as he stood in the inner court to overlook the architects, without fear or suspicion, he was assaulted and laid breathless on the ground by two resolute prisoners of the Paleologian race, who were armed with sticks and animated by despair. On the rumor of revenge and liberty, the captive multitude broke their fetters, fortified their prison, and exposed from the battlements the tyrant's head, presuming on the favor of the people and the clemency of the empress. Anne of Savoy might rejoice in the fall of a haughty and ambitious minister, but while she delayed to resolve or to act, the populace, more especially the mariners, were excited by the widow of the great duke to a sedition, an assault, and a massacre. The prisoners, of whom the far greater part were guiltless or inglorious of the deed, escaped to a neighboring church. They were slaughtered at the foot of the altar, and in this death the monster was not less bloody and venomous than in his life. Yet his talents alone upheld the cause of the young emperor, and his surviving associates, suspicious of each other, abandoned the conduct of the war and rejected the fairest terms of accommodation. In the beginning of the dispute, the empress felt and complained that she was deceived by the enemies of Cantacuzini. The patriarch was employed to preach against the forgiveness of injuries, and her promise of immortal hatred was sealed by an oath under the penalty of excommunication. But Anne soon learned to hate without a teacher. She beheld the misfortunes of the empire with the indifference of a stranger. Her jealousy was exasperated by the competition of a rival empress, and on the first symptoms of a more yielding temper, she threatened the patriarch to convene a synod and degrade him from his office. Their incapacity and discord would have afforded the most decisive advantage, but the civil war was protracted by the weakness of both parties, and the moderation of Cantacuzini has not escaped the reproach of timidity and indolence. He successively recovered the provinces and cities, and the realm of his pupil was measured by the walls of Constantinople. But the metropolis alone counterbalanced the rest of the empire, nor could he attempt that important conquest till he had secured in his favor the public voice and a private correspondence. An Italian of the name of Facciolati had succeeded to the office of Great Duke, The ships, the guards, and the Golden Gate were subject to his command. But his humble ambition was bribed to become the instrument of treachery, and the revolution was accomplished without danger or bloodshed. Destitute of the powers of resistance or the hope of relief, the inflexible Anne would have still defended the palace and have smiled to behold the capital in flames rather than in the possession of a rival. She yielded to the prayers of her friends and enemies, and the treaty was dictated by the conqueror, who professed a loyal and zealous attachment to the son of his benefactor. The marriage of his daughter with John Palaeologus was at length consummated. The hereditary right of the pupil was acknowledged, but the sole administration during 10 years was vested in the guardian. 2 emperors and 3 empresses were seated on the Byzantine throne, and a general amnesty quieted the apprehensions and confirmed the property of the most guilty subjects. The festival of the coronation and nuptials was celebrated with the appearances of concord and magnificence, and both were equally fallacious. During the late troubles, the treasures of the state and even the furniture of the palace had been alienated or embezzled. The royal banquet was served in pewter or earthenware, and such was the proud poverty of the times that the absence of gold and jewels was supplied by the paltry artifices of glass and gilt leather. I hasten to conclude the personal history of John Cantacuzini. He triumphed and reigned, but his reign and triumph were clouded by the discontent of his own and the adverse faction. His followers might style the general amnesty an act of pardon for his enemies and of oblivion for his friends. In his cause their estates had been forfeited or plundered, and as they wandered naked and hungry through the streets, they cursed the selfish generosity of a leader who, on the throne of the empire, might relinquish without merit his private inheritance. The adherents of the empress blushed to hold their lives and fortunes by the precarious favor of a usurper, and the thirst of revenge was concealed by a tender concern for the succession and even the safety of her son. They were justly alarmed by a petition of the friends of Cantacuzini that they might be released from their oath of allegiance to the Palaeologi and entrusted with the defense of some cautionary towns, a measure supported with argument and eloquence, and which was rejected, says the imperial historian, by my sublime and almost incredible virtue. His repose was disturbed by the sound of plots and seditions, and he trembled lest the lawful prince should be stolen away by some foreign or domestic enemy, who would inscribe his name and his wrongs in the banners of rebellion. As the son of Andronicus advanced in the years of manhood, he began to feel and to act for himself, and his rising ambition was rather stimulated than checked by the imitation of his father's vices. If we may trust his own professions, Cantacuzini labored with honest industry to correct these sordid and sensual appetites, and to raise the mind of the young prince to a level with his fortune. In the Serbian expedition, the 2 emperors showed themselves in cordial harmony to the troops and provinces, and the younger colleague was initiated by the elder in the mysteries of war and government. After the conclusion of the peace, Palaeologus was left at Thessalonica, a royal residence, and a frontier station, to secure by his absence the peace of Constantinople and to withdraw his youth from the temptations of a luxurious capital. But the distance weakened the powers of control, and the son of Andronicus was surrounded with artful or unthinking companions who taught him to hate his guardian, to deplore his exile, and to vindicate his rights. A private treaty with the Krull, or despot of Serbia, was soon followed by an open revolt, and Cantacuzini, on the throne of the elder Andronicus, defended the cause of age and pride.